oxygen that was injected into our blood began to change us in miraculous ways. I saw how your father loved you, and I knew I had to show that same love to the turtles. I became their father, and they became my sons.
Welcome to another episode of the Turtle Dojo, a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles podcast. As always, I'm your host, Adam, and with me is my co-host, Chris. Chris, how's it going?
Awesome, man. Happy to jump on here and talk some more turtles with you, buddy.
Always a fun time, and this time is especially fun because we are going to be sharing our thoughts on the original 1990s Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles live-action film. It's something that we've been talking about doing for quite some time, and then I realized that we are in the year of the 30th anniversary of that film. So what better time to talk about it than now? I mean, technically, we missed the actual anniversary. I'm trying to find the
release date anniversary.
Yeah, which I'm trying to find, but I can't seem to. Oh, here it is. I'm going. Yeah, it was March 30th. So we met of 1990. So we missed the actual release date, but we're still in the 30th year, and it counts. So, and it's our podcast. So as long as we do it within the year, we're good in my estimation.
Yep, as long as we get this out before that calendar flips to 2021, we're still good.
Oh, we definitely will, for sure. But before we actually get into the nuts and bolts of the film, one bit of news item that I think is relevant is the producer of the film, and let me get... Let me get the names correct here. Okay, so we've got, let's see, the which is Bobby Herbeck, has been doing the rounds talking about, you know, the 30th anniversary, and Kim Dawson.
This is a big Kim media Dawson. Year.
Yeah, so the two of them are doing the media rounds, and you know, talk about the film, and you know, I think back in September, there were a couple of limited Fathom events where they showed the movie on the big screen, you know, for whichever theaters were open and willing to do it. So they've been making the rounds discussing, you know, the 30th anniversary and doing interviews on, you know, what it took to get the film made, etc. So, you know, all the behind-the-scenes fun stuff. And, you know, the writer and the producer have talked about having discussions and pitching a... Now, they worded it as a reboot. But I think... their use of the word and what they actually mean are two different things, because what I'm understanding is they like to do a continuation of
Yeah, it sounds like they mean the reboot just in the sense of, like, they're bringing it back. I don't think they're going with, like, starting over.
Right, exactly. So now, when I hear the fact that they've had conversations, my first reaction is, who have you had these conversations with? Number one. Two, why have they not greenlit it yet? I understand, you know, the logistics of, you know, we're in the midst of a pandemic and all that jazz. So from that perspective, I understand it. But two, why have they not greenlit it yet? And to me, I think, now I understand that we have that Seth Rogen produced animated series, or sorry, animated movie that's in the works. And that's all well and good. I'm super excited for that, as you well know. But I've always been of the belief that with a franchise like the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, that has such a wide fan base, there is room for multiple interpretations to coexist at the same time. And having an animated film is one thing, and having a live-action film is another. And I think, again, you can satisfy multiple demographics by doing such a thing. And I think, so if somebody with what I would say would be real common sense would actually say yes to this, I think it would have to be Paramount at this point, correct? Because they have the rights to the franchise. If Paramount had some good sense, I think they'd say yes to this and get the ball rolling to whatever degree they can, because I think this is a great direction for the franchise. I mean, you yes, it's going back, but what I think you do is you'd hook in the nostalgic fans our age, right? But I think you'd get even young kids engaged to see something like this, because what are your thoughts on that, on the whole thing about them, you know, pitching the idea? Do you think it's the right way to go? Give me some of your thoughts.
Well, from a personal standpoint, the 1990 film is still my favorite Ninja Turtles film of the, I guess, 8 that have been released. And like you mentioned, with the younger kids, my son loves this movie, and he loves the second one. The third one, not so much, but he loves 1 and 2. So if he knew that this was coming back out in theaters, I mean, I would already be going to see it myself, but he would be like, Dad, take me to see the new Ninja Turtles movie. So I think they would nail it as far as capturing the generation that grew up with it. And we're old enough now that we have kids that we're showing it to, and they love it too. So I'm all about it.
Like, I showed it to my, here's a limit. I mean, I don't have my own kids, but I have nieces and nephews. And I showed it to my nephews, especially, I've shown them the first one. I haven't shown them the second one yet. But they love it. So, you know, and they're, the boys are ranging from, I want to say 11 and 13 years old.
And see, so, my son is 6, so you have a wide range there of kids that would be into it.
Yeah. And again, I think there's no... obviously, you'd spruce it up with the advancement of some visual effects. But, I mean, imagine, and we'll get to it in a second, but imagine... You know, the Jim Henson Studios, the created the suits, right? Imagine them doing that now with the technology and materials they have at their disposal.
I mean, you can see in superhero movies the leaps and bounds that have been made just in, if you want to use one example, the Batman costume from the 89 Batman with Michael Keaton, which came out a year before this movie, to the bat suits that they have on film now, and how much easier it is for the actors to move in them. Of course, I mean, that's just one example. If if you were able to translate that over to the Turtles, I'm sure it would be a lighter type of material that they would use, not quite as heavy as the original ones. Plus the advances in animatronics, they would be able to give real reactions in the faces of the Turtles. So I think you're 100% correct.
All right, so here's my next question. Let's pretend that if everything was right with the world, and we know it's not, but if everything was right with the world and the stars aligned and we got our wish and this was greenlit, okay, with the original writer and the original and this producer coming on board, would you want them to do it in the same style but completely start fresh? Or would you want them to kind of sort of take a Superman Returns-ish approach of, all right, the first two movies happened, and we're picking up from there?
Yeah, that sounds good. We don't really have to reference Turtles in Time, I don't think.
Again, but I mean, yeah. I enjoy it for what it is, but it's not as good as the first two. But
able to jump back in and reinvigorate the franchise, like have it be a continuation of the original ones, but still set in present day, not taking place in the 90s.
Yeah, right. I mean, just pretend that those events happened 5 years ago, or you know, 5 to 10 years ago, as opposed to the actual 30 years that they took place from. Right. So, by that same token, if they said, okay, we're going to use the same style and the same techniques, upgraded, but we're gonna, you know, it's gonna be a fresh start while using those that same kind of stuff, just with the people that did it before. I would take that too, but like I said, I think you have a chance here to really sort of get a multitude of audience members like us that grew up on those originals, but like you said, your kids, my nephews. And I think why I think the rare times I'll give him any props, but I'm going to quote Bryan Singer and say, if you want to do the requel approach, I think it works. Now you have to do, you know, you have to have the right balance of, you know, character work and action and stuff like that, which Bryan Singer lacked in Superman Returns, but. You know, the requel idea is a smart concept for if you're going to take this route. And to me, it just screams like it's a winning formula. Because what, you know, no matter, like, whether it's us or you see it in the marketplace, like, you know, there's action figures coming out based on the 90s film, the style of the film. So what does that tell you, right? Like that's, and those things sell like crazy. So, I mean, the writing is on the wall. It's, to me, I would love it. Like I said, I'll be there, you know, whether it's first in line, or I'll be one of the first purchases from my couch, however it has to be done, for that animated movie with Seth Rogen. But I don't understand, and from Paramount's point of view, why limit yourself to just, hey, it's only got to be animated? I mean, take a page from DC and how they've got live-action TV, live-action movies, and it's all coexisting and all happening at the same time. Do it. Like, I think this brand is popular enough to sustain that. So, if this were to happen, it sounds like we'd both be on board for it.
Oh, yeah, man. Sign me up. So, fast track it into production.
Paramount, get it done. And, hey, if you're filming in Chris's area, you know, hire him to work on the set.
Oh man, if I knew there was a Ninja Turtles movie filming in Atlanta, I would be on that set. I promise.
And then my co-host could be my special guest interview, who worked on the film. Kill two birds with one stone.
That's right, baby. So, cross-pollination.
That's right. So figure it out, get it greenlit, and let's go. Is my recommendation. With all that love for what might have a potential to be, let's talk about what was, and let's talk about. Let's go back in time to 1990 and let's discuss this film. So, Chris, when this movie came out, what were your initial thoughts?
I mean, as an 8 to 9 year old kid seeing this in the cinema, it blew my mind. It was everything that I wanted from a live-action Ninja Turtles movie. I mean, I remember the night that we saw it in the theater. I remember leaving the theater, and they were handing out stickers for RoboCop 2, which came out later that summer. I remember it very well. I remember going home and being like, I cannot wait to see this movie again. And this was in the days when a movie would be in the theater, you know, 6 months to a year before you would get a VHS copy of it. And it didn't come out for that Christmas. We had to wait for the next year, for 1991 is when it came out.
Yeah,
and
I remember the Christmas commercials. Yeah.
I remember getting it for, you know, I remember getting the VHS when it came out. That's how much I loved it. I watched this movie so many times growing up as a kid, and I watched it earlier today, and it's one of those movies that never gets old. I love everything about it.
I remember that for me, this was at least the one that I can remember. This was the second film that I saw in the theater. The first was Batman 89, and then this. So my ages of 6 and 7 had two great movies that I had seen. And because back then, it's not like, you know, I was going to many movies that, like I would now as an adult, you know, go as many as I can afford. You know, usually your parents took you, and they were selective with how many movies you get to see a year, right? So for those 2 years, the two movies I saw were those two. And I remember absolutely loving it because I have faint memories of watching the cartoon, right? A couple years earlier. I think was correct. Am I right with the time frame?
Yeah, I think the cartoon
debuted
in 87, so it was 2.5 to 3 years before this.
Right. So I I don't. I can't pinpoint. Hey, I remember. I was. You know, sitting on the left side of the house watching this episode. No, but I remember that it was present, and I had, you know, I had toys of it, and so I already enjoyed them. But watching this on the screen, like and this goes to how good the suit designs were. I believe that those turtles were actually there.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I didn't know any better to say, hey, those are actors in a suit or stunt performers in a suit. Like, when I saw those things, it was the Ninja Turtles. You know what I mean? And those two movies had such an impact on me, along with, I want to say, Power Rangers in 93. So those three things, Batman, Ninja Turtles, and Power Rangers, were, from my point of view, my parents put me in karate for a totally different reason, but from my point of view, when I joined karate, my goal in life was from this training at karate, because I was young when I started, that I'm either going to become A, Batman, B, I'm going to transform into a Ninja Turtle, Or C, I'm going to be drafted into the Power Rangers. You know, I'm going to be one of the Power Rangers. Neither of those three came true. Although I did get, I do have a 4th degree black belt. So I guess something came out of it. Not exactly what I wanted, but I got some value. I've gotten some value out of it. But so that's how much, you know, of an influence I think this movie had on me. And getting into it, like, what I like about it now as an adult is you're 100% right. This thing holds up.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I don't look at it and say, man, that technology sucks, or that looks that looks horrendous. Those turtles still look damn good. Okay, there's a couple scenes where you can see that, you know, the puppeteer in the mouth, right?
But right.
That's few and far between. On the whole, it looks really good. Like, I mean, and what I like about it is they throw you right into the action. Like right away, you're told the crime wave in New York, right? The gangs and the theft are being done by you know, perpetrators that are essentially ninjas or at that point, I think April says they're dressed as ninjas or something along those lines. So you're thrown into the thrust of the problem right away. And, you know, I love the intro of the turtles, how you basically don't see them outright when they make their first save. You know what I mean?
Yeah, when they first save April in the parking lot. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes.
Yeah, so Raphael throws his sai at the street lamp that's lighting the area and knocks the light out. So it's pitch black. You hear the turtles going to work on the Foot Clan, but you don't see them until after they go back down in the sewer.
And that was such a fantastic way to do it. Like, even now watching it, and I made the correlation. I don't think he took this as the Turtles movie as a reference, but didn't it kind of bring about memories of Batman's first appearance in Batman Begins?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I mean, he's in the darkness, and
right,
you hear him and you sense him more than you actually see him.
Yeah, I just that like they've really, this film does a really good job, especially at the very beginning, of emphasizing, you know, the aspect of, you know, the ninja aspect of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Yeah, right after we meet them, when they're talking to Splinter, he is imparting in them how important it is to stay in the shadows and not be seen.
And what I love about it, too, is right away, like once they're in the sewer, in brief interactions, you get a clear understanding of the dynamics of the four brothers. You know, like Leonardo's the dutiful son and student, right? Michelangelo, who's always playful and goofing off.
Right? He's on the phone ordering a pizza when Splinter's talking to them.
You know, Donatello, you even get a sense of his intelligence or the fact, you know, how wise he is and all that. And then Raphael, like the anger that he has of, oh my God, I can't believe I lost my son.
Yeah, when he says, damn, I almost lost it as a kid, I was like, what? The Ninja Turtles cuss?
Yeah, language. Hey, I can almost see Captain America sitting in the theater. Language. So it's like, very quickly, you know, you get a sense of who these characters are. And honestly, I think it was spot on with what I remembered as a kid from the cartoon. I mean, this was a little bit more serious than the cartoon played it, but the interactions and the character, the essence of the characters, was the same. So they really captured that well. And Splinter, I mean, there's the obvious, you know, Yoda kind of comparisons. But even, like, you know, I've never been a fan. As a kid, I was never, oh my God, you know, rats are not exactly the most endearing, lovable animals, right?
Yeah, I mean, you see April jump on top of a box when she sees one at the beginning of the movie.
Right.
Which is, of course, foreshadowing when she sees Splinter later and absolutely loses it.
Yeah, but you can't help but like, the way they've done Splinter, they balance that you know, wise father figure, sensei type, but also, like, this cute furball of a thing. Like, he's not, I wouldn't say he's as cute, but he's got that Baby Yoda kind of vibe going to him. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, today kids are all like, oh my God, Baby Yoda. Like, back then, I think Splinter would, like, if the same ingredients were available, I think Splinter could have had that effect, despite being, by his very nature, a rat. I like the fact that we got you know, when Raph again is out on his own and he rescues April and then brings her back to the sewer, to the lair. And then once she awakens and you said she freaks out over Splinter, but then he and the turtles tell the origin story. I love how it was told in flashbacks.
Yeah, it's sort of like they use the same storytelling technique in the cartoon when April awakens in the lair and Splinter begins to tell her the story. So it kind of follows the cartoon in that aspect, but in this we get the actual, like, we get the flashback showing the turtles crawling in the ooze. And of course this varies from the cartoon in that in the cartoon Splinter is Hamato Yoshi, who was transformed into a rat. In the movie, Splinter was the pet of Hamato Yoshi. Splinter was the rat that was the pet of Hamato Yoshi. So, of course, it varies from the cartoon in that aspect, but in the storytelling device, it's very similar.
Yeah, absolutely. There is a difference, but the essence is there, as you say. And it's like, I just love the fact that it's not a linear story. Like it's proof that, again, we don't have to have, you know, A to B to C. Like there's room when telling an origin story to do that. And then, you know, some of my favorite movies, Batman Begins is another one that also employed this technique, right?
Yep.
And Man of Steel was another way, you know, the way they did Superman's origin. So, you know, it's really, and again, I don't know if either Nolan or Snyder took, you know, reference from this. I'll never know unless I ask them, which I probably, let's be honest, I'm not going to get the chance to do. But for me, I definitely see those parallels, and it shows you what a trendsetter kind of this movie was in that way. And I would venture to say, just before as we continue, I think this movie, in tandem with Batman 89, did so much to revolutionize the superhero genre.
Oh, for sure.
But what I also like from April's point of view is that, I mean, she got herself into some hairy situations, you know, where she needed rescuing. But they made a point to show her as a competent reporter. And
yeah, I mean, the movie starts off with, like you were talking about, when we learn about all the crime wave in New York City. That's told to us by April. She's the first character we meet in the movie, and her news report really fills you in and sets the stage for everything that's about to happen.
Yeah. And like, even, like, she calls out the police chief, right? She's like, you know, what kind of a job they're doing. So, yes, she gets herself in trouble, but she's a very proactive, go-getter type of reporter. I mean, and that's important because too often it would be so easier to make her the damsel in distress.
Well, she gets fired in the movie for standing up to her boss and questioning the police chief. Obviously, I'm going to go through the movie a little bit here.
Yeah, I mean, spoilers. I mean, we're talking about a three-year-old.
Right. Her when her boss's son, Danny, gets arrested, I believe, with a stolen car stereo or something,
yes. Yeah.
And you see the police chief call Danny's dad, that's when he makes the deal off-screen with the police chief that he will let Danny go if he comes down on April a little bit and kind of gets her
right.
to stop questioning him on TV. And then when she questions the police chief live on TV, that's when we get the call that ends up on her answering machine at home telling her that she's been fired. So yes, sticking to her guns and calling out corruption or calling out the bad work by the police, it ends up to her losing her job.
Right. Awesome. You're 100% right, man. I just love her the way they wrote for her and the way Judith Hogue portrayed it. I thought she was great. But what I liked about this movie as well, Chris, is that throughout the movie, like, we're dealing with big themes and big stakes here. Like, you know, we're talking about, you know, they're hitting you with a theme of loss, right? Like, Splinter mentions it at the beginning when he's giving that lesson, right? While Michelangelo's ordering pizza. And he says, I'm not going to be here forever. You know what I mean? Like, he's basically giving them the pep talk. And you even see how Donatello and Michelangelo are affected by it while they're waiting for the pizza delivery. Like Michelangelo tries to like deflect by being humorous, but Donatello is really concerned of the day that they won't have Splinter around. And then beyond dealing with that loss and preparing the turtles for that, you're talking about gang violence, which is something you'd never think they're going to put in a kids' movie. You know, or what you'd stereotypically think of as a kids' movie.
Yep.
Like, that kind of stuff is unheard of. And the way they showed the kids that were susceptible to the Foot Clan is that, you know, people that feel like outcasts in society who don't have the best relationship with their parents. Like,
I mean, when I was a kid and I saw this movie, I saw that underground lair where the kids live, and it has skateboarding, poker, video games, cigarettes. Like, when I was a kid, I was like, hey, man, I want to go hang out at this place. I could be in the Foot Clan, like, because I thought of, you know, myself as an 8 or 9 year old kid, if somebody took me down there and was like, hey, man, you can hang out down here all day long, I would have been like, this is sweet.
Right. But as a younger kid, it may go over your head, but as you rewatch it now, you're like, wow, they're really dealing with some you know, legitimate, you know, grown up adult themes here.
Yeah, and I think another theme that's pretty prevalent in the movie is the love between a father and a son, because you see that with Splinter and the Turtles, and then you see the way that Splinter connects with Danny and is telling him about the love between a father and a son, which when I was a kid, I was kind of like Danny. My dad was a nerd and, you know, not cool and didn't care about me. But then as an adult watching this movie, now I'm seeing it from the father's perspective, and I'm thinking, even if my kid is a screw-up like Danny, obviously I'm still going to love him, and I'm still going to do whatever I can to try to help him out and to get him out of trouble when he gets into trouble. Yeah. So, I think those are the major themes.
And they even go to dark places in some of the, you know, via some of the big action pieces. Like, it's very early into the movie where Splinter is taken right? Like, he's literally kidnapped.
Yeah, and the turtles are without him for the whole second act of the movie and most of the third until they connect with him at the end.
Yeah, and it's beyond that, it's like, look at when, you know, Raphael goes out and he's frustrated because they're not looking, he perceives them as not looking hard enough for Splinter or doing enough. So he takes off on his own and then is confronted by the Foot Clan, and he's overwhelmed. And he's thrown through the roof, you know, the roof. I mean, the injury he sustained is pretty serious. And especially as a kid, you're like, I remember thinking, is he going to make it? Is he going to be okay? Like, is he going to die? Is he, like, what's going on here? Like, they really put some of the lead characters in distress where you actually are concerned of, are they going to end up on the right side of this at the end? That's almost, you know, to date, that's pretty much unheard of in a movie that's aimed towards children. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's pretty heavy for a little kid to see those scenes with, like you say, with Splinter and with Raphael when he is, you know, pretty much invalid.
Yeah, yeah. And then, again, like I say, they have that scene where you know, they connect with Splinter via, how can I phrase this? Almost like telepathic, using, you know, almost like using the Force, for lack of a better word, you know, by where they're meditating, right? And he appears in the flame, right?
That's one of my favorite scenes in the movie.
Right, yeah. And it's just like, it's a great scene, but the overwhelming emotion of the scene, I think, is what's really cool about it. Like, again, I hate to keep harping on this, but you normally wouldn't see that in this kind of a movie back in the day.
Yeah, and to see that connection that they have with, you know, with their dad, you know, like you said, the Force, yeah, for lack of a better word, but it's very similar. It's like, yeah, you know, Yoda or Splinter is the Yoda figure,
yeah,
or the Obi-Wan figure, and you see them able to connect with Luke from the other side of the Force. So
yeah,
it's almost like that. You're right.
It's another great scene. You know what character I think really made an impact on me, has just been really cool, and kind of, I wouldn't say he stole the movie, but he stole some scenes for sure, and that's Casey Jones.
Oh yeah, he's a great character in this movie.
The Elias, Koteas, yeah, I think it is. He was just phenomenal in the part. And reading the books now and seeing the character now, it's almost like the character has, in other media, has taken on aspects of this performance. Like, that's how good it was.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, he still has the hockey sticks like he did in the, you know, when you meet him in the comic book, but I think Elias Koteas' performance just informs the character so much that now, when I read the character in comics, I still read it like in his voice, you know what I'm saying?
Oh, absolutely, yeah, absolutely. He was just so good. And that scene with him and Raphael, where they have that fight, A, is right out of the comic that we read and reviewed.
Yep.
We talked about, and it's one of my favorite scenes in the movie.
Yeah, it's your introduction to Casey Jones, and you get to see Raph like goofing on him a little bit, and they're goofing on each other. So yeah, it's a really good introduction scene with Raphael tripping the thieves, and then Casey Jones swinging into action to rough him up a little bit more, and then Raphael saying, "Hey, buddy, like, I think they've had enough, or they don't need to learn their lesson from you." And then you have your two protagonists squaring off against each other. It's a classic tale out of comic books, but it's really well recreated for the movie.
Yeah, yeah. And again, one of my biggest things when two heroes fight is that they both end up looking strong. And I think in this case that does happen.
Well, and I think, you know, they developed a respect for each other out of that fight, because later in the movie, when Raph is getting jumped on the rooftop, Casey Jones sees it through his binoculars and he runs over there to help Raphael.
Yeah. Agreed. 100%. And I think that another thing that was that really stands out about this movie is what a great villain Shredder is.
Oh, he's a great villain, and you don't even meet him until over 30 minutes into the movie.
Right.
Because at the beginning of the movie, it's all about the thievery, but then you meet him when he comes into the kid's lair to address them and give his little speech. But his presence is felt from that point on through the rest of the movie. You're right, he's a great villain.
But he's so, like, I think it's the fact that for a lot of the movie, he's silent. And his whole look, it's just so imposing and frightening. Like, it literally,
it's kind of like a Darth Vader sort of. Like, you know who this guy is as soon as you see him. You know he's bad news, and he doesn't even really need to say anything to make his presence felt.
Right. And again, you know, as he starts to hear about the turtles and then see them in action, he starts putting, you know, sort of two and two together of I've seen, you know, where have they learned those techniques before, from what are these things, and as it's revealed that, you know, the connection between Splinter and him, it makes everything that happened even that much stronger once you know the history and the connection. And again, spoilers, the fact that at the end of this movie, he seemingly, quote unquote, gets killed. How many movies can you say, superhero movies, kill the main bad guy?
Yeah, at the end of this, as a kid, I mean, I thought he was dead until the return of Super Shredder in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2, but when Casey Jones throws the lever to start the trash compactor in the back of the garbage truck, you can see the metal bending. Now, you don't know if it's the metal from his helmet or from his arm gauntlet or whatever, but when you see that getting crushed, you definitely think this guy's dead.
And again, that was a scene pulled right out of almost literally right out of the comic, which is cool.
Yep.
You know, I think that scene, And the Casey versus Raph fight were two that were literally pulled right out of the books, which was awesome. One of the other things I want to talk about and get your opinion on is, I think these go hand in hand. From a martial artist point of view, the fight scenes in this were, like, the martial arts in this were great.
It's really impressive what those guys could do in those suits.
Yeah, very accurate, you know, very. And like you said, the way they could move in those suits is impressive. And I just like the fighting techniques. And again, this is what happens when you get martial artists in the suits. The authenticity of the movements and the techniques is really something special. And I think a lot of movies nowadays, it's more like, let's make it look overly fanciful, like a ballet.
Yep, agreed.
And this one is more true to form and true to reality, so I appreciate it on that level. So, what is your, let's if you had to pick a favorite action scene, what would it be?
Ooh, favorite action scene. That's a good question. I think probably the scene in April's apartment when they're taking on all the Foot Clan, and Roth comes through the fire escape or through the window, and Casey Jones shows up and they have to escape because everything's burning down. I think that sequence is probably my favorite. It's just so well done. It shows Casey cares about Roth because he shows up to the apartment to try to help. And yeah, I think that one for sure.
That would probably be mine as well, just because there's so much going on. Like, it's chaos everywhere. But yet again, you still get to see the skill and the technique of it all. And I love that balance. And I kind of also, so in addition to that, I kind of also like the the sequence in the third act where the turtles take on Shredder and they absolutely get destroyed. Like, he takes them all out.
Oh, yeah. It's Splinter that ends up getting the drop on Shredder. But, yeah, he does take down all four turtles.
Because, I mean, don't get me wrong. They get some good moves in, but he's eventually able to overpower them. And I think what that does is it shows that, it reminds, I think, the viewer that, yeah, they're good, but they're still teenagers and they're still inexperienced.
Well, and that's also informed earlier, like you already mentioned, when Shredder says he recognizes their fighting techniques, that's the reason he's able to defend against them so well, is because they're the techniques that his master, or that Hamato Yoshi learned from him.
Yeah. No, it was, so, but yeah, those two scenes are what happens to be my favorite. But again, the fighting was top-notch throughout the movie, I think. And all the action scenes were executed very well. I really like, another thing that's worth mentioning has got to be the cinematography of this movie and like how it visually looks. I mean, everything. The set design, it all looks, there's an authenticity, like a real world feel to this thing, that despite the fact that we're dealing with, you know, four walking, talking martial arts doing Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, it feels like it exists in the world outside our window.
Yeah, they do a really good job of grounding the movie with some of its, you know, comic book type ideas, but you nailed it. Like, even the set design, when they're in New York, you feel like you're in New York. When they're out at the old house out in the country, you feel like you're, you know, away from civilization, and like you're right there with the characters. They did a great job.
Yeah, it was fantastic. And again, I'll reiterate it. Those four suits, for the most part, with a couple of exceptions I mentioned earlier, still absolutely hold up.
Yeah, everything about this movie holds up. Even, you know, just the banter between the turtles and Michelangelo, you know, when he's cracking jokes. It's always well done and well executed. It never takes you out of the movie.
It was pitch perfect. And there's just, like I said, not very many movies can you watch, I think, especially in this genre, and say, yeah, the one from 30 years ago still holds up. It's very rare.
Yeah, I love the movies that I enjoyed with a kid that I'm able to watch with my kids, and they enjoy it also. You know, that's really, like, if it holds up, that's kind of how I can test if a movie holds up or not. Like, if my kids can watch it and get enjoyment out of it just as much as I do, then you know it's well made.
Yeah, and I kind of like the, you know, back in those days, I mean, the 90s and throughout the 90s, these movies were, you know, they came with, you know, a popular song that went along with them. And that song, the Turtle Power song.
Oh, yeah, it's fantastic.
It's right up there. I mean, you cannot be a fan of this movie and not watch it and then immediately be, for the next couple of days, humming or singing along to that tune.
Man, it's in my head right now. Thanks.
Yeah, that's what I mean. You know, it's just so, it's so good, and it just, I even like the music video, damn it, for it. But yeah, there's so much of this movie that just, it's so great. And again, we're 30 years on, and I watched it yesterday, 2 days ago, and not once did I think, oh my God, okay, this is getting tired. Like, I was into it as much as I've been into some of the modern movies, you know, that I watched recently. So, I mean,
oh yeah.
So, yeah, it's so good. And again, it's not that I'm looking at it with, I don't think I'm overly stating that because of the nostalgia. I just think that, again, the fact that you can show it to your kids who don't have predisposed history to this film, or my niece and nephews who, you know, until I showed it to them, didn't know it exists, and they think it's good. I think that's the barometer. That shows you that it has stood the test of time and is still just generally solid, and the concept and the style of filmmaking is viable. So, I mean, it's just, it's one of those, it's just a great movie, no matter which way you slice it. And they told a lot of movie in a 93-minute runtime.
Yeah, that's something I was going to mention, is that, you know, it moves pretty quickly through that hour and a half. Like, you have your definitive, like, your act one, your act two, your act three. They're almost divided up exactly equally at about 30 minutes per section, but it moves really quickly throughout the movie.
Yeah, very well paced. Very well paced. I can't say enough good things about this movie. Truly, I can't. Is there anything specifically that we haven't touched on that you want to touch on before we give it a rating and wrap it up?
Not really. Just, you know, I think it's the perfect combination of the comic book and the TV show, because you have your darker elements, and like you said, there are a couple of scenes that are ripped straight out of the comics, but then you have some of the cartoony violence, you know, when the turtles are goofing around while they're fighting the foot, you know, a lot of that comes from the cartoon. So I just think it did a really good job of blending those two worlds so that both the comic book readers and the kids who were fan of the cartoon could enjoy the movie.
Yeah. I agree with you 100%. It's the perfect mix of the original comic book and the cartoon. And I think that's been an issue with subsequent recent adaptations, is finding the balance between...
Yep.
'Cause when you have a property like this, the balance then becomes now appealing to the younger generation while also appealing to the older generation of fans, or the original set of fans. And that's a balance that they've struggled with in the more recent adaptation. But here, they hit all the right notes. And so, yeah, I love this movie. It's one of my absolute favorites. So let's give this thing a rating.
Oh, this is a solid A. I mean, I guess an A plus. If there's a whatever the highest letter grade is, that's what it is.
Yeah, for me, it's an A plus. I have literally no problems, no nitpicks whatsoever with this film. I just, from start to finish, I absolutely love it.
Yep, I mean, I think I might have mentioned this on another podcast that we did, but from the very beginning of the movie, when the New Line Cinema shows up on the screen, when I was a kid, I just knew New Line as the people who produced the Nightmare on Elm Street series. So when that came on the screen, that was my first thought. The same people that made Freddy made this. From that very moment when the New Line Cinema shows up to the end of the credits after the songs are finished, the movie's just a blast to watch the whole way through.
Right. I agreed 100%. So there you have it. 2 A pluses from Chris and I. If you have time, revisit it now for the fact that we're in its 30th anniversary.
See what it you holds think. Up. Watch yeah. it again.
See what you guys think. Let us know in the comments if you have any, if you want to share your thoughts on the movie. And let us also know what you think about the potential to revisit this style of Ninja Turtle film in the form of a follow-up, as the producer and writer have been talking about. So let us know. Share your thoughts with us. We hope you enjoyed this episode, because we enjoyed talking about this movie, so we hope you enjoy listening to it. And if you want to continue talking to us about the Ninja Turtles, you can on social media. So, Chris, where can you do that?
Well, you can check us out on Facebook in the Multiverse Musings Podcast Network group, and any comments on the post about this video, I'd love to interact with you there. Or you can find me on Twitter at Chris N. Harrelson.
Right. And I am also on Twitter at Adam_LeesFan. So if you want to follow me there, we can talk about anything superheroic or podcasting-wise that we do here on the network there. But that wraps this episode up. As I said, we hope you enjoyed it. And we hope you will join us next time. But until that next episode, we want to remind you that the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles are forever, from Splinter's first educational lesson to the last. So long, everybody.
Take care, guys.
Hey, what do you guys want to eat?
Pizza!
Cowabunga, dude.
Go, Ninja, go!